Okay, let's start the final leg of this journey. Let's do the discussion part, the round table, basically. Okay, so this is our chance to discuss some of the stuff that we put on the table previously, both in the event that we have experienced and also the lecture by Renske. But may I abuse my role and ask the first question, or maybe say something about how I felt immediately after I've seen the event itself. I witnessed it, experienced it. It reminded me of this book that was very influential in artist circles by Alva Noy, Action in Perception. And he immediately really wanted also, I think he carefully chose the, Staros is stuck. Can somebody open the door? Thank you. Thank you. So what I mean by this action, what does he mean by action in perception? I think what he means is that if you think about it in evolutionary terms, why is it that we perceive? It's because then we can act. But I think what is thank you so much. Thank you. But I think what is even more interesting, and that's why I want to do the reversal. It's not only that we perceive in order to act, but more crucially, I think, and this is something that I have felt deeply when I saw the event, we act in order to perceive. Because there is no reality, as it were, ready-made to be mapped, but we actually create space by way of creating a movement that helps us experience the potentiality of the space itself. And let me immediately give you an example, and I think comes directly from the book by Alva Noy, but also people like Evan Thompson, who wrote this Mind, I forgot the name of the book. Is it the Mind in Action, I think it's called. He says, just think about the moment if you were to close your eyes and somebody hands over an object to you, and you were just allowed to hold it without moving your hand over its surface, it would be very difficult for you to tell what it is. So it's literally, I mean, this is not a metaphor. In order to actually perceive something, you actually have to move. You need this action. And then it becomes, the moment you start caressing the object, it's immediately clear what it is. So action is for perception, but perception is also for action. And I think we've been chatting during the break. I think all of these attempts are to show that before jumping to conclusions and dividing between acting and perceiving, I think we have to put them together, because what comes first is the experience itself. And allow me just one more proof. I was shocked to read about this very cruel experiment. It was done in the 60s, and it's a contraption that looks like a carousel, like a merry-go-round thing. And you have two kittens, newly born kittens. One of them walks, moves, and propels the thing, and in the process of it, observes the environment. The other one does not move; it's suspended, and it can just see. So one is moving and perceiving; the other one is just moving. Perceiving, and it's being moved by the other one. And you release them, and the problem is that they are perfectly healthy, psychophysical terms. I mean, if you examine the eyes and everything, but the kitten that was just moved. It's virtually blind. It bumps into obstacles because it hasn't actually developed the sensory motoric ties that profoundly, as it were, connect the perceiving with an action, with movement itself. So I think I want to start there and ask. Let me just a third one. It is curious because I also read somewhere that people who happen to ride horses while they are shooting bows and arrows are much more precise in aiming and shooting the target while they are moving on the back of the horse. And it's also curious, but I think it's also because they, by movement, they have more information and they can, it allows them to actually have a better sense of what is going on around them. in comparison to somebody who is just standing still and has no extra information in order to unlock the capacity of the space itself. So I've given you three possible arguments in favor of this idea that we cannot ever think about perception, disengage it from movement and action. So how about that? Okay. But I formulated it as a question. Would you say that Ma actually circumvents the problem? Whether you know, it doesn't actually even allow us to start at the point where we have to consider whether it's action is for perception or perception is for action, because it's already kind of intertwined, entangled to such an extent that we start from the, what you call the middle, which doesn't necessarily mean between the two things. It's actually something that comes prior to anything, you know, prior to perception and action.
I think that's true. I think even if you say Ma is an embodied approach, you already make a problem, because then there's something else beyond the body. And I think in this sense, action and perception are indeed in Ma the same thing. Although you can also, you know, experience as the same thing and think about it as two different things at the same time, I would say.
Yes, upon reflection and
But I would also like to know from you or the students.
I'm also thinking about the horse riding in the bow and arrow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a bit what Renske said, it's the being the environment also. So it's really all the time also extending, it's not this and the horse, it's one thing and the environment is one thing, so you become one thing and then you can be so sharp.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because you control it in a certain way. I mean, it's
all your movements. Mm-hmm. So it's all the stuff. So the kinesthetic devices we have, and then you can become. Then you're even more sensitive to the whole environment. I think you can be more precise. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you control it. So you're put in an act.
Mm-hmm. So perception, in that sense, you could say it's not passive, it's not receiving stimulus to be interpreted, it's active, it actually requires you to have an active...
It's a skill.
It's a skill.
Yeah.
Mm.
And you
can sharpen it, you can make yourself better at perceiving.
And you can develop endless skills in perceptions.
Mm.
I think this week we developed skills, everybody develops skills, no matter how subtle.
And it never stops, I suppose, no?
Wonderful.
They say the developmental psychology, they say that you know, very often they use this contraption also. It's again a merry-go-round above the head of a baby in a cradle, because it has to slowly kind of integrate this movement and try to understand how is it, what happens, you know. Because it's not just an image that looms. We don't perceive images. I think this is another lesson that we have learned today. There was a moment I was standing behind the gentleman who was struggling with the chairs. Who is it? You, yes. And it reminded me of this beautiful attempt by Duchamp when he draws the naked lady descending the stairs, because all these chairs were almost like, I could see them together with you, you were the last in the sequence, almost like providing for an attempt to render movement and time in one image, all of you know, together in this sense. And then it also curiously made me think that it is Duchamp himself who was very critical of this, what he called retinalism, the painting that believes that we are actually perceiving images. Because I think everything that we've seen today is points to the possibility that we might ditch this idea that we have ever, perceived images. Images come from representation, from painting, but not necessarily from experience. The second order perception. Yes, we do perceive images, but it's not how we experience the world itself. So I think it's what you said. I think, and it's I was also very pleased to learn recently that the plasticity of the brain never stops. In the first 6 months, it's monstrous. I think we develop 100,000 neural connections per second. Later on, it slows down, but it never stops entirely, which I think proves your point that we can continue to learn, we can sharpen our attention, we can become better at perception, and that continues. But it requires...
make it stronger with architecture, or train it.
Yes.
Otherwise, it slows even more down, I think. So, can I ask something to everybody? Because, I was wondering just for reactions or questions in general, because I felt like in the audience there were comments coming up or questions coming up. So, I'm curious.
What is the untranslatable part between Ma and space-time? Well, or is that part also a Ma?
I think you're referring to the image where Isozaki has crossed
well,
the...
Well, just this concept of Ma.
Uh-huh.
So you said in the beginning that there is no... right English word for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what do you feel that is?
Well, if I would start talking to you about space-time, would you feel that? Without having this experience and without having this lecture?
This is a difficult question because it's not my mother tongue, English. So you're saying that individual experience or
yeah,
this cultural
example,
experience is
but also
untranslatable?
Yeah, and also space-time still is a kind of concept hanging out there. You know, and Ma is that also. But it's trying to grasp something you can sense in a kind of word. I even think Isozaki came up with this word Ma, not in his Japanese context, but mm-hmm. when he was working on an exhibition here in Germany.
Yeah.
And he needed to explain to somebody what he was looking for. And then he came up with the concept. So sometimes I even think actually Ma is an English concept, used from Japanese language, but then in retrospect. So he invented the concept here, and then went back to Japan and was like, oh, we're going to explain it like this. Because this Ma is a kind of particle, and it's used in at least five dimensions, I would say. So you can use it, you know, measurement from here to here, but also in volume, also in space, in time, but you can also use it to denote the quality of somebody's speech or the quality of an atmosphere. You can come in here and say, oh, the Ma is bad, I will go away.
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't like the person. Or it has a really good Ma. So it's much more than space-time.
It's something he invented, but not a traditional concept.
Well, in Japanese language, this Ma is used in all these kind of dimensions I just explained.
Yeah.
but the translation as space time and using Ma to do that, I think he invented here.
So the translation he invented.
Yeah, but also the use of Ma
in Western context discourse.
Yeah. How can I explain this?
But it wouldn't be the first. We know that it's like Scottish kilt.
Mm-hmm.
It was invented, I don't know, 19th century. Retroactively now it seems to be like the thing. It's always been there. There are many, I think, examples of it.
I think if you translate Ma as space-time, you miss this whole felt part and this quality part. because we don't use space-time to, I could walk in here and say, oh, the space-time is not really good, I go away. Mm. But this is not something that we regularly do. So that would then we start to use space-time also in English in a different way than we're used to doing.
Understand maybe Ma in terms of harmony of force, because if you like, just like an example, if you talk about this bottle and then what I see is bottle and it is situated in a space and time, mm-hmm. but actually something is more than bottles. You have mm-hmm. the gravity while you have the reaction force.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you are talking about, is it more about if you really need to experience the whole mm-hmm. like more than bottle, including its force, then you need to be experienced is providing the counterbalance so mm-hmm. that is it will stay at it. So that there is another layer which is more.
You need to experience its whole relationality, how it's related to the environment. And I think indeed harmony and force are also words to describe that.
What you're saying, it cannot be a universal concept that applies to everything. It's always relational. It always depends on the circumstances, on the very specific conditions, I think.
But I would definitely say try to experience it before you give words to it. You know, during this 1.5 week, we also invented our own specific words for Ma. Because at a certain point, you're just fascinated for something, and you think, oh, yeah, but Ma is much too big concept. This is a really, really specific part of how things relate to each other, or how things are experienced.
Because I think it would be really interesting about the lecture, because I don't know what exactly the concept of Mark, but that word is the Chinese character. So I understand more about that character actually, because there was the two door in it and there was a moon inside.
Yeah.
But actually in Chinese word there was another word, there was sun inside.
Yeah,
so I just checking on the internet, there was in the ancient time it used the same they just changed a little bit from the sun to the moon. So just like there was a space. There's a void inside, it was empty, and there was the time was flowing, and moon and sun, just like the time over that day by day, just and then space change. And I'm curious about, because there was another concept called a floating space,
mm-hmm.
that, like a floating space mentioned by Ms. Fenneroy,
mm-hmm.
because the space was, there was no door in his
mm-hmm.
buildings,
mm-hmm.
The rooms are connected,
mm-hmm.
but there was no variable separation
mm-hmm.
between them. But when I experienced that space, it was quite different from the floating space concept in Chinese
mm-hmm.
context. Because when I stand in the Ms. Fenneroy's space, I just feel like they are like flexible.
Mm-hmm.
But in some Chinese garden, a Japanese garden, what you experience is that the space was changed much more than it, including the atmosphere, the lighting,
mm.
the wind, the sun, all the things was changing. Just like, or is that the difference between the space you experience that? Because not the space, just like in Ms. Fenneroy's place, it's more like an objective
mm-hmm.
thing, just like you think they're just object, but when you're go around inside the Chinese garden or the Mars space
mm-hmm.
maybe, you can feel more about yourself. It's a
mm-hmm.
subjective experience
mm-hmm.
to enjoy the space. Is it, I don't know, well, I just understand why or not, but is it just the difference between
mm-hmm.
Those space in Ms. Fenneroy and Mars?
Well, unfortunately, I have never been in Ms. Fenneroy. but I really enjoy your explanation, and also to make the difference between flexibility and floating space and movement space, as I call now the Japanese approach to it. Because I think there is indeed a huge difference in taking into account only if walls are a bit flexible, or I don't know, in contemporary architecture we have, you know, everything needs to be flexible because the use might change. But this is a completely different way of approaching movement in architecture than the Japanese or Chinese gardens that happen here. So I really enjoy listening to your experience in this. And I would
agree with you. Let's say it like that. So, about that word, the character, there was two doors, then there was some sun or moon inside. It also means gap in Chinese meaning, and also means Tie, because we you're the second character of the tie in Chinese word. Is it? I'm not sure. It's between the third dimension and the fourth dimensions. So, yeah, I'm not. I'm just being really interesting to think about it.
Yeah. So it's one thing. It's not split, it's not space, and it's not time, it's not third or fourth. It's a combination of these two, and that's why they refer to it as space-time integration. And I think, you know, it's not only in China, but also in other character-based languages that they use this character, all referring to this relationality between body environment.
Space Lab Masumi believes that we should never talk about perception and action. It should be the hyphenation, action perception. It's the time space always coming together. But I was thinking also in terms of your question. Before we started, we had a little chat about this book that was just published, and the title is very telling. It says "From Object to Experience" by Mulgrave, an architectural theorist. And he lists the whole tradition and the change of mood or change of attitude or change of heart in the past maybe 10, 15 years, where people are more interested in the experience rather than object. Because maybe I just remind you, every time you speak about the object, you start from a presupposition that there is a subject that then engages the object. So that you already start from as it were, like two different worlds that have to be somehow bridged or connected. But if you start from experience, then you don't have this problem. You might have other problems, but certainly it's not about trying to figure out how the subject accesses the object. It's now about the experience that comes first and perhaps eventually it's about the primacy of experience and privacy of movement that produces what eventually we could recognize as this or that. But it's also, I think, something that you said about the we shouldn't insist. Anything that we want to, we always face this problem that the expression is never adequate to the content itself. There is always something that is impossible to put in discursive terms in language, because there's always something missing, I think. We are forced to say something, spell it out, and then we think, but now we have fixed it somewhat, but now we have lost the elusive, wonderful entanglement that does not really in any way allow for this kind of forceful reduction to one word. So I think we have to emphasize the relationality of that object, because it's not universal, it doesn't work everywhere the same, but it attunes us to the possibility that perhaps we should have always been attuned to what comes, that the experience comes first before we can distinguish between the subject and the object. Because that experience actually turns you into a different object, to go back to this idea that you said that we can still learn how to perceive. You can actually train yourself and adapt a certain disposition of perpetual curiosity and learning that actually affects it changes you profoundly. You become as a subject. You're never petrified. You never stop. You're always transformed in the process.
This reminds me of a discussion we had during this week. said, as soon as you know about Ma, you see it everywhere. And
yes.
My whole perception now of the world is differently. And I'm suddenly attracted by other things and a different way around it. And this is what happened a little bit to me. And what I see even on your also. Can you explain how or share how it should work?
Well, I don't know like how to explain it really. It's just like kind of like this moment where you start to like it's just Ma is kind of like a tool how to really like pinpoint down your like how your experience or your perception changes in relation to like like the world in general.
Can I use an example that I often use, and curiously it has to do with you and the fact that you are a free climber. And I always say, when I happen to be in front of a wall or a cliff, to me it's an object, because I wouldn't know what to do with it. For you, it offers an opportunity to engage. You immediately, perhaps unwittingly, see how you could negotiate, how you can actually do something with it. And I think this is the description of, again, what Koki was telling us in terms of, like, you can learn these things, and then it's a different space for you. Certainly, then I'm a good swimmer, so I consider myself like to be really very advanced in terms of getting into a partnership with any body of water, and I feel very confident there. I suppose in comparison to somebody who is who can't swim, for them the body of water becomes an object. It's something simply observe it, but no chance of engaging it or doing something with it, and with not just with it, but literally kind of propel yourself through it. I think it, maybe at this point also it's when I'm circling around this idea of object and subject and all of that, I think it's also we might as well mention the distinction between the factual knowledge that we have always relied on, the knowing that today is Thursday and there are 25 people in this room, as opposed to the issue of experience, where you can't really use this propositional kind of, you can't rely on the propositional knowledge, because in order to swim or to climb, you can't have a manual that tells you this is how you do it. It's always a matter of doing it your own way. And by your way, I mean depending on your constitution, your strength, your muscles, your tendons, your style, your state. Are you hungry? Are you tired? And I think this is actually there are experiments where they say if you have a backpack on your back and you ask to estimate the height of a mountain, you usually say that it's higher than it is. The same way if you have sprained your ankle, the staircase looks steeper than it is. So it's, I think Ma is also about that. It's about this relationality, something that, again, it's as much objective as it is subjective, but it's neither. And I'm here drawing it to this other concept that I think it's akin, the concept of affordance, that we always estimate affordances. Like we see the door, we don't need to measure it with the meter. You always see it in terms of the width of your shoulders. The same way that Merleau-Ponty says when a lady walks with a feather in her head, she bows every time, she dodges when she needs to go through the door. And she doesn't need to think about it. Or the same way that you, when you drive your car, you don't have to calculate all the time, okay, now the car extends this much. You're already in the car, and as you're navigating, you already extended. Your body is one with that piece of machinery.
What I really liked when we were 2 days ago here in the morning, mm-hmm. to test the space out, we were one of the best moments was that in the first hour, four students started to lay down there, mm-hmm. and start to sleep on the floor. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, that's what this means. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Everybody was, you couldn't get off your chair. It was so the room is really, mm-hmm. you know, like this. Mm-hmm. So sleepy. And I think it was a great It felt so natural. It was beautiful.
Yes.
And then you started to sit, just eating your sandwich, contemplating, okay, this room needs something. And people started to change their things, and suddenly, we're working on to activate the space.
Mm.
So you will start working from the place itself, instead of doing it to it or something.
Mm-hmm.
It takes time, and slowly you turn it into a territory. Mm.
Instead of drawing the plans and section and animation, and I draw a lot of perspective drawing. And because I think when I, maybe all of the students focus on the plans and the animation about the composition of in the modern architecture education, and something lost, the atmosphere is lost, the experience lost, your feeling is lost. Smell and music, background music, everything is lost. So I just discussed with my tutor, but in the end, he also think you have to finish those drawing at first. But I think I share one of the story because one of the tutor, my bachelor, gave a lecture about Chinese garden, and he think once a time he walking in the Chinese garden. He saw a lot of our foreigner students were just checking the dimension of the alley, checking the how tall is the stone, about the ceiling. I think it's stupid thing to or ridiculous thing to do it, because when Chinese people do Chinese garden, maybe I think it's almost the same with the Japanese garden. They just do it. By just perceive how it looked like, how it feels, because they who built those gardens is not did not hire a lot of worker or builder to do it. They just live in there, they stay, they live in the house and do the garden separately, step by step, by a few years. So a lot of things is not mentioned, it's not decided at first. Did not make the drawing at first and then call the worker and builder to do it. But they just standing in the site and see what exactly looked like, and then to add some stone that was the digging out a pool, and then plant a tree there to make it feel better. So it was to do the things before they make the drawing. A lot of drawing about a Chinese garden or something, now you can see it is after they build it. It's by some scholar. They think it was the crucial to make the marks about, to make the record about those things, because they think maybe they were lost sometimes. So they make those drawings, but it's really quite different from the section and plan, because the way you see the plans there and see the section of the all this garden, you cannot feel anything. But when you go inside the garden, you can experience it's totally different, just like into new world. You cannot imagine by those drawings. So I think it was really good thing to use. Because it's impossible to let everybody to create a one-to-one space or some model to do it, but maybe to use the movie is a little bit better, because movie, even though it will lose some about the smells, sense of smell, but it will still have the moving along the inside the building, and you can use the camera to emanate what you actually look like when you're turning around, what you exactly looked at, and the focus point in this, and about the sounds, about the atmosphere, they can catch it. But if we only use the drawings, maybe a lot of things were lost. So I'm thinking maybe just use movie would be better to help you design something.
Obviously, not trying to ask your tutor if you can skip the
floor
and just deliver a movie. I don't know.
I'm just thinking, but it's still hard because I have never. I know some of the tutors in China and also want to just try to do it, but I don't think it works very well because it's really difficult. To use a movie to instead of a plan section to help you develop, it's like really difficult, I think. Because I haven't.
There is a Dutch architect, Lars Spybroek, who has written an essay, and he says, "Wouldn't you find it curious that whenever we think about action, it always takes place on the floor?" So we draw in architecture, we consider it via floor plans. And wherever we think about perception, it's about elevation or section of the building. So, and he says it is reincarnates the division, the Cartesian division between body and mind and, you know, action and perception. It's already inscribed in the way that we design, because somehow that we consider movement in terms of the horizontal movement and perception in terms of vertical elevations, and he wants to put these things together again, and because he says it produces a certain kind of architecture, because we simply, you know, like it makes it easier for us to maybe operate in this way. But something that you said about this movement, it's very profound, because if you think about it, if you make it, you know, if we consider the primacy of movement, then even the moments of stillness are special cases of movement, rather than the other way around. So it's not that film is a stitching of a lot of stills together. It's actually the stills are extracted from the movement itself. So the movement comes first. I referred earlier to Brian Masumi, who says that even walking is a controlled falling. You fall and then you regain your balance only temporarily, so that you can throw yourself out of the balance again. This is how you walk. I think there was also, I saw this in the Deschampian. You have this image, you found it. When you were moving, trying to find the balance between getting off the balance in order to move and then regaining the balance. Can we turn it around? This is the image I was, the nude descending the staircase. I saw it I took a picture of you. This, there was one moment like this. You were in this sequence of, this array of chairs and yourself as the one of the elements.
Very hard to see.
But it's the nude descending the stair. There are also series of photographs. I think Muybridge and Murray have been doing this the flight of birds, and you know this horse galloping.
He made a film, and
yes,
then
yes,
he
yes,
screenshot.
Yes, exactly.
I'm just curious as a person who hasn't been related to any of it but seen it now, like how have you worked with it, the concept in your like in this assignment or exhibition?
How it comes about? How it's it's a good question.
He asked, how did you came to this? How did you work with it?
What are your thoughts about it?
Why did you choose the mediums that you chose?
Yeah, I think we kind of had like a pretty straightforward approach in the sense that like we first read about the catalogue of the Japanese exhibition, and then we all found like some excerpts that most resonated with us, and like maybe resonated with like some ideas we perceive. So we were kind of like, I don't know, at least like I was more like tuning into like my own perceptions about space and like what are the qualities that appeal to me. So we did like a lot of different tests, and yeah, some were like just group tests and some were just individual tests, and so we just like developed various just small experiments. Yeah, I don't know about others' experiences.
Maybe in the corner there. How did you work?
Yeah, I think just the concept of Maya is also very subjective to how everybody perceives it and feels it. So in the first days, we just go with our intention, like as each person, and then we just try all these things together and see how, like you just get the information, because as also when you're doing something as a group, you're doing this all as a group, so it also becomes this kind of electricity, and people give you feedback, and you also give the other people feedback. So it all kind of just like almost like unknowingly comes together somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there's a lot of process that you went through that you don't even realize until you go and look back at it.
It sounds a little bit, I'm reading about a production that William Forsythe was doing, and I think as part of his process it was about these kind of, you know, fixed choreographic elements. Maybe they were more traditional ballet, and they were kind of constructed in such a way that they were placed within the performance, and then between those there was improvisational parts. But the improvisational elements, they relied on communication between the dancers, and it was kind of interesting because then the dance kind of, I don't know, I guess it progresses in time, and because as you look at each other, you know, it kind of changes. And I think there was one performance they did where someone was, you know, sick, and they realised at that stage that, you know, how important it was, that communication, you know, that breakdown in the communication was...
Oh, miscommunication. Also. Miscommunication.
Yeah, miscommunication.
Mm-hmm.
And also I think those kind of rigid elements are a little bit kind of similar to in the way you were talking about the objects, because they almost sit in, you know, the objects almost sit in the scape that we kind of occupy, and maybe our improvisation is that kind of, I don't know, the hinges between those objects, almost.
Well, we had also once Victor Lukoff also sick by drawing a big circles, sort of soda on the floor, and in the morning you get sick very quickly. So you were turning till you couldn't turn because you get so sick. And then you excused yourself, and we were all like, no, this is fantastic, you know, because it identified the space. So you work with so many unexpected stuff when you work on the floor. So I think, I don't know how it is, how you can estimate. I think it's very difficult to work in a movie. Personally, but I'm very curious how it is for others of the students. If you can imagine that.
That this was a movie. A performance that was a movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it will work out. Because what was actually happening was the people and the room that were part of this whole experience. Because it's hard to portray the experience on a camera, I think. It's possible, but it's probably really hard. And if you're not part of something, you can't really sense it. I mean, you can probably, but it's really hard to do it.
If you would make a movie to try to create a space, it has to be the most realistic movie ever, with the texture of the carpet and the texture of the walls, what you see through the windows, like everything that you can visually perceive is a part of it. and that's something that you can transfer to movie, but Ma is more than only what you visually achieve, it's also smells and sounds and the feel of the room, so I don't think it's something that you could recreate in the film.
So manipulated time space, I think, because it's, I mean, the camera lens is not the same thing as the eye, so.
That's very true. I think the latest consensus among the community of neuroscientists is that we actually really perceive 4% of reality. Everything else is added on. And I think you're quite right to say that in terms of perception and the distinction between the perception camera itself, the distinction is that it's external perception, you perceive the world, but at the same time you're perceiving yourself perceiving. There's this proprioception which cannot be recreated by use of camera, and I think so it's literally impossible to reduce that. But of course, you can make movies, but then it's a different, task
but
altogether.
The visual that encounters the rational experience,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And you want really have the experience and the feeling. So then you cannot reach that with only an image that's moving.
Yes.
So. Right.
Point taken. Yes. Indeed, I don't think anything can be. I'm all again. I think any attempt to reduce the richness of experience to one medium is always is about excluding. Yeah, it's excluding something. It could be an art process. I think painting does that, but it's impossible to have a one-to-one, as it were, mapping. Just something has to be lost and. It's just the way it is. But I was also thinking, if I may just, because I read this a few years ago, that there was a research somewhere in the West of Germany university where they asked people to walk in perfect circles, but wearing only a belt that would buzz when the side that was facing the north. So when you walk, you know, this buzz, they used, I think, a simple device from your telephone. And when after 3 weeks, I believe, they could do it without looking. So they developed almost like a 17th sense that made them, they could actually walk perfect circle. Eventually, they also used this. There was another problem for helicopter pilots who have to land the helicopter in a desert because they can't really see the moment of touchdown. So very often they would crash it. So what they did, they also implanted these buzzers in the, what do you call it? The belt, yes, the two belts. And of course, at that point they trained, and after, again, 2 or 3 weeks, they could actually land the helicopter blindfolded because they relied on this. Again, it was the haptic, they somehow short-circuited the site. So I think we can, it's amazing what can be done. And I also saw a person who is using just a simple camera, that transforms images into sounds. And this person was blind and it was riding a cab and telling us, I think we're passing by a big building now, it's a picket fence now, it's this. Now. So I think it's incredible how we plastic we happen to be. So that is to say, I think it's as you said. With these how else would you appropriate a certain space, make it a territory, unless doing something? I mean, you can't even see things unless you move. Most of the visual illusions are very problematic because because they always rely on a certain immobilized point of view, and then you start imagining things. But if you're allowed to move in space, very soon you can map it, and you know what, you can understand how it works and what it allows for. So I think there is a great lesson there for anybody who is interested in, I'm not allowed to say space-time.
Do you think the reproduction of the exhibition change it, because you know we're talking about that in different mediums.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reproductive element. Do you think it loses characteristics when it goes to, you know, when it's moved from place to place? Do you think it's?
Yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a similar thing as, you know, you have the original of the 53 stations between Tokyo and Kyoto, and then somebody is doing it again and seeing it in a different way. But I think what in the end is the most modest is action itself. And that's why we were proposing to redo it, just make it, but it could be a completely different experience in the end, but just the process and approaching it and working with it. I think it's a similar thing that we worked in the Hague, and we had all these kind of works, but then Gokki said something really smart. Okay, we go to this room on Tuesday and we forget about everything we have been doing, but we have like developed these skills, and then see within the new space how can we work with it, and some things we had already last week, but other things completely evolved here.
That a few works change a lot, or left out, or added.
It's interesting, it reminds me, because I used this recently, there's a beautiful piece by Claire Colebrook on learning, and she starts by etymology of the very term. I don't know if there are any Italians here or people who speak Latin, educare. She says it is about leading, but leading out. In other words, forgetting what you have learned, you know, in the previous room, because that doesn't help, because now the circumstances have changed. So it's almost as if the essential part of learning is leading out of something that you already know, so as to do something,
yes,
do a repetition in difference.
Continuous development, never fixate.
Yes, yes,
so
yes.
Keep on going, keep on moving. So it's this plasticity.
Yes, yes.
What you said about. So, and that is a sense that you can, it keeps on going. As long as you fixate, you're lost.
Yes, yes.
And it's wonderful. So I think we trained that also together, and it was beautiful. And then it's also not too hard to let things go.
Yes.
No problem.
No problem.
And I think this is also in the exhibition itself, because Isozaki made this tea house, but then in Paris it was completely different than he did in New York and Houston. And I think he also just concluded it doesn't work. I need to come up with something else, and other parts can be. So there are all these kind of, you know, according to the environment, little iterations will
develop. Yeah, because the Japanese element is very strong in it. So how cultures respond to that, appropriations.
I was thinking, just to pick up on what you said earlier, there are people who strongly believe that no event should ever be recorded because it, in some way, it's an impoverished version of what has happened. That's one way of looking at it. But you could also say that any repetition brings something completely different, precisely because it's not meant to reflect of what happened, but bring it forward in the way that you mentioned earlier. But the other, my question, and I think we have talked about this in our correspondence, 40 years ago, Japan was probably very idiosyncratic from the point of view of a Western gaze, or whatever we want to call it. Now with the global the condition, you know, the globalization, the movement, everything, do you expect that there will be something different? I think the contrast is not as big as it used to be.
I think we should say there is no contrast at all. That's not completely true. In that sense, that there is a huge difference between, but I don't think we are as surprised anymore. What's this? It's not received anymore as this oriental thing.
Yes.
Although some people like to still keep it that way. But I also see it as a kind of just like this zigzag. It doesn't mean you literally build a zigzag, but it's something. In Japanese, you know, in martial arts they call this kata. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of movement form. A thing you start with, and then suddenly it emerges and develops, and you have this practice. But what actually is important that it's your skill when you work with it. So by remaking, by going from Kyoto to Tokyo again and do it again and again, you have a tool to see and develop and maybe by doing that, you can also apply it to design of architecture or design of something else. That's how I understand it.
Okay. How did you choose this room? Did you choose exactly this room?
Yes. There was no choice.
Gracefully, you just embraced it.
So, because we were first assigned room B. And for those who don't know, room B has fixed chairs.
We thought this was bad.
So I think we had like 2 meters up front, all the fixed chairs to work with. And then we kind of did our best to at least get this room.
This is white pessimism. It can always get worse, you know.
So
no, I'm asking because I think this room is really Japanese. With these shutters and these structures, I mean, you can really, I feel like it. And also when you slightly open the cabina a bit, you had a feeling of the Chinese house or the Japanese house. I mean, this is also a bit, yeah, it's not so far-fetched. I mean, also Bruno Taut made this connection between modern architecture and the Japanese house. So, and also this orange carpet, it's a color which is prominent in Japanese painting, I think. And I'm not a specialist, but I have this.
I honestly think this is a huge compliment to the work done today. You have to understand it like this, because when we came in on Tuesday, I think you should take it like this, because we showed you the Japanese part of this room.
Yes, I mean.
Yeah. Or do you think something else?
No. I'm just checking. Did anybody of you have the feeling of a Japanese room when you came in?
No, but I understand what Alex is saying. Mm-hmm. The movement, the change of light, I can. I understand.
Yeah. So that's what you guys activated.
It was like directing my view also of this, and seeing the probabilities.
I have one thing. It's just I find it really funny that you mentioned movies in this, because to me movies is the most passive thing. Mm-hmm. Like as a spectator you just sit. Mm-hmm. But in the same way it can be like emotionally very, like it moves you a lot. Mm-hmm. And like with new mediums like VR, you actually have the possibility of interacting now or moving in the space. Mm-hmm. But it's still not as strong, or I haven't tried anything as strong as the movie. But then, like, and you use the word direct, like picking out our attention. Mm-hmm. And through the picking out, actually like guiding our behavior into an emotion. Just
maybe also the concept of composing or curating. separating, because I was also thinking that the concept of Ma, I thought it is also a way of composing, like just accept, and this is maybe not the perfect word, but maybe also it is, that there happens something between objects, and they get into kind of this just the way of a really sensitive kind of composing. It's
I think
I also was thinking of how you can teach that.
I'm thinking just to again follow up concern to do with film and your concern, how do you teach that? I think it's helpful. I have recently again reread the second chapter of McLuhan's Medium is the Message, and the second chapter is called Cool and Hot Media, and it deals with this idea that any like movie is a hot medium, and that's what makes it so passive, because everything is given. So you could say that it's high participation, high resolution, sorry, in terms of information, and low participation, as opposed to cartoons that are cool media, which means low resolution and high participation on the part of the beholder. So you could say that cool media cool medium forces you to participate, and therefore you are co-constitutive, to use your, what is it, the term that you use, like you co-determine, you are, nothing is given, you are producing as you're consuming at the same time, and maybe that's a virtue of any cool. What is the term you use,
co-becoming?
Yes, co-becoming, yes, you could call it that. In that sense, it's not all is given for you to consume, it's, you're already required, you're also required to contribute by participation. So high resolution, low participation, low resolution, high participation. That's the formula that McLuhan offers. I mean, that's, in terms of teaching, I think it's, some people have actually used it in architecture. They said you could also argue that.
I think during the week we also discussed a lot this idea of playing a music instrument and listening at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Thing. And then a lesson can be as simply as like reading together. This, we didn't do it, but it's almost as simple as that. To just open up your sensitivity to it and then start to test, okay, how does it work if I listen and act at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I would say this co-becoming.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can only teach this.
Something you don't listen and play at the same time, so you take a step back and you combine pre-existing pieces to make the end result. And if you use Ma in a creative or way, then you find things that are already there to find what it's supposed to be. So it seems quite similar, but instead of having this idea of what it's supposed to be or what it could be, and you're working towards this end result, like you have to find it.
Mm-hmm.
But in Western culture and language, there seems to be a not as great as a distinction as it actually is. For example, if you compose a music piece, you have this feeling that it's done by composing the notes in a certain way and changing the volume. But if you work with Ma, you don't have this feeling that you've created a finished piece, but you have the feeling that you've found what was already supposed to be there. And I thought for me that was a big difference in working with Ma. We
because it's something that you can feel and it's something that's already there.
Another way of looking would be to say that the first attitude that you're describing is this hylomorphic, when you have an idea, so you manipulate your environment in order to actually make this idea happen.
Yeah.
And with Ma, I would say that it's more like giving in, getting again into a sort of kind of more humble position where you, as you say, manipulate what is already there, not imposing your will onto the inert matter, but working with and through the matter to produce something that surprises even you as a creator. So you're not fully in control. It's as much about surrendering control as it is about control. Kind of very, very different from what we are taught at any academia or where you're supposed to be the genius who knows exactly what he or she wants and then manipulates everything around to get to the goal. So in that sense, maybe the when you insist on this movement, it also, it's means to create means so as to produce something eventually. You're not sure what the end result might be, I think, so you're not that much attuned to the end result. What comes to mind is beautiful line by Brian Eno, who says, I'm not interested in creating a score for the music, but I'm planting seeds for something to happen that I, as a creator, will be also equally surprised by. And he's recently now, you probably know his latest exhibition is that he says, I haven't seen probably 90% of the, because it's creating this algorithmic way images. He says, I always want to go to my exhibitions because I don't know what to expect. This is quite a surprise. But it's because the Western artist is the genius who is so talented that he has the capacity to impose his or her will on what we consider to be like stupid, inert stuff, so as to produce a work of art. I think this is radically different. This is like really, there's no megalomania of ever being in control. It's about co-becoming, you said. I love that. You are becoming as much as anything else around you. And I think we have seen this in the opening act. Because it's different. I think it was different from the rehearsal. I was lucky to see a part of it.
I was totally surprised
about
some elements.
Yes, and that's it. This
so,
is.
So we also said to each other, some things are there, but we don't know exactly. So if you feel this has to happen now,
go for it.
No, I don't mean too polite, but take your moment. So Ivan really did that. So I think we're all surprised about elements. You're all sharp to. Okay.
I was just also thinking it has to do with like in architecture, or at least I have this stereotype image of architects and architecture, that it can be this cold thing, people sitting with like drawings and rulers in a coldly lit environment and like making these shapes, and then poof, there's a building, and then when you get into it, it feels like clinical or something. Like, I think some of the ways you can use it is to like the doing tests. Like, this is also the end product of a lot of tests, emotional tests, where you said tried out things and then this worked and this felt made me feel like that. That can work, and then you're kind of getting there. But prototyping or making models is also important in architecture, and like how does it look when you produce like small scales and put yourself into environments that you want to like go to, or like that could, yeah, I don't know if it's the, that could be a way maybe.
I also wanted to add that one of the things that I found in this room, and also what I wrote about, is that in Western culture, and for this example in architecture, we work with space. So the people who make this building, they envision this space and they built the walls around it because they wanted this here, and they felt like this was the space to be, and this is what it has to be. But then what I felt in with Ma, so in the Japanese way of thinking, that if you would feel this space, that it looks nothing like it wants to be. Like it doesn't, I hate all the walls, all of the carpet, the pillars, the placement, the location, everything about this room feels just wrong. So I think that in that way, the Japanese architects would never have constructed this room. They would have made it completely different, just because they don't look at the space that they want and they create the walls around it. They see a void, and they know that this void wants to become something else, and they fill the void up to create what is already there. So they use what they feel is there, and then that's how they construct rooms, instead of the Western way of, I need a space here, so boom, here it is, let's go.
Yeah, but it's also personal.
Yeah, of course. But it's, of course it's personal whether I like this room or not, but it's the distinction between wanting to put down a space without thinking about like how it feels, Ma-wise. So then of course you first have to learn how to experience Ma. And then creating a space or a room through Ma. I think those are two very opposite ways to create building spaces, rooms, everything.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know about the capabilities of Japanese architects, but I think what is really important in architecture, because there's always a site where you build, and I think it's really important to go to this site and experience the space, and not like you describe, sitting in this cold environment, drawing plans and then put a building out there, because this is actually exactly what happened today.
Can I once again recommend this book, because I've recently finished it, and I think in that sense it really addresses all these issues. It's called From Object to Experience by Harry Francis Mulgrave. Really chapter by chapter, it describes exactly what you're saying. The problem is that the practice of it's impossible today. I mean, it's simply all the means that our disposal for designing require a certain kind of precision from the very beginning. And that precision translates into a building eventually. Does not allow for what Robin Evans at one point talked about, this translation from design, I mean, from thinking to building, because in that gap many things can happen beyond control, your control, for better or worse. Now it's so tight, because the means of representation immediately become the means of production nowadays. There's no surprise. There's nothing. There's no gap. The gap is fully closed. And I think, we can celebrate it because there is no mistake. But there is also not a possibility for anything new or surprising to pop up or emerge.
Because so, there is no time.
There is no time. Exactly.
Because
yes. Exactly. Exactly. Because somebody was talking about this, how pleasant we find things that accumulate in time. And this is, again, that Richard Sennett and other people say that we find so pleasing about cities, because it's not about one person having an idea and making it happen. It slowly grows cumulatively in time, and time it becomes essential, I think.
And I think it's also how you go to space. Because sometimes you go to space and you think,
This is not just a reflective thinking. So
tea house in Japanese. And in Japan, they did not just build a room, because in their culture,
mm-hmm.
the inside tea house is another room.
Mm-hmm.
They are just why they make the hold a really small hold in tea house and not on the floor, but a little bit higher on the floor, because they want you to be humble and just like really carefully to just
mm-hmm.
jump into the other world.
Mm-hmm.
Just and they build it really small, but because there was their land is limited or something. And also in Chinese garden, why they want do a lot of things and build walls and create put the stone there and plant trees there. Is because at the beginning some people really like go traveling in the landscape, but after they come back to the urban context, urban places, they don't have the chance and money and time to experience. They could not go traveling all the time, so they build a really small room inside the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Just sometimes
mm-hmm.
they not build it exactly the smaller garden. Is they want to build the whole world inside the
mm-hmm.
garden, and how to do it? It just because sometimes I don't know whether you have ever seen. There was a war there, and there was a stone, just a part of it,
mm-hmm.
Beyond that wall, just like make them to imagine, oh, there was this mountain behind the
mm-hmm.
wall,
mm-hmm.
So something like to invoke your imagination about you are not just stay in a really small space, but you are in a part of the nature.
Mm-hmm. Microcosm.
Something like, so that's the how the original thing they think of to build a garden or the small space.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a question, because the topic is mapping the rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
So in the music score is the method to map the rhythm, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But in for the architecture or for the space, do you think what do you think the better way to maintain the
rhythm?
Because for the exhibition here, the movement,
mm-hmm.
if you do all just the drawing, the 2D drawings,
mm-hmm.
you cannot represent it very well.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the more effective way to do it?
Mm-hmm.
I'm always struggling with this. I never know. But like within the context of this exhibition, I would say make time frames. So just as the Tokaido images, you know, you have this one, and then this one, and then this one, and then this one. And then there, because there's also one map where they are all in. And then it's reversed, so you really have also to work with the map in order to do it. But if you really want to do it, we might need to find a new way of notation.
We give you a course.
So
find out.
That's
because I read something about the chimney.
He
used something like mapping the movie,
mm-hmm.
mapping the movement,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not sure whether I understand it very well. But I think it didn't work. some kind of thing, I felt a little bit bullshit for it. Just because I could not understand very well and. Even to do the things about the design, I cannot feel that the.
I think
the
if you look at this
relationship with the original.
If you look at the specific period when this exhibition appeared, and then look at Tumi and Kohas and all those people that were also interested in movement, the writing, you can find a lot of
evident, and then you can conclude for yourself if it's bullshit or not. I think it's really hard also because, you know, depends on, do you want to show how it's, you know, in the architecture and use it as the architectural plans we normally use, or is there a problem already there, and do we need anyway a different way of representation or not at all? I think this is super difficult.
Yeah, I think it's a try.
Yeah.
Try, but not a good one.
But it's also, if such a subjectivity should be part of the process, maybe it was meaningful to him, like, and you can't objectify subjectivity, so there are no, like, boxes that are one answer.
Merleau-Ponty has this concept of optimal grip. He says when we are confronted with a painting, we find the best distance to observe as a beholder. You are just given the, you know, whatever the it's depicting. You find the right distance, and I think that can be generalized in terms of architecture. You know, like how is it that we distribute layout so as to speed things up or slow them down. This is what could be rhythm. I mean, in this particular case, you could say that this asymmetry of the door creates a kind of really not an isotropic space where every single point in the space has the same capacity, the same intensity, but this asymmetry introduces modulates the space so that doesn't bear the same intensity at every single point of it. So I think there are subtle ways. And then distributing or divorcing your possibility of action with the possibility of perceiving, these things don't have to be perfectly aligned. There is a lovely moment I have recently watched again, Mulholland Drive of David Lynch. You have this moment where the lady collapses and the sound continues as if she's standing, she's singing in this. So they divorce the image from the sound in such a radical way that it does something to your mind and you're not sure what it is. So there are also moments, I think, in architecture that this can be employed, the framing, the moment where you allow for, you know, that you can modulate experience so that you allow for perception and action to reinforce each other, but also to set them apart deliberately so that they can... So, for example, when I'm sitting now, I can see the orange hall, but I also realize that I also happen to see the exterior, first the piece of interior, an exterior, and another interior. And it provides for a particular kind of experience. And I think the layering, the guidance, the subtle guidance of movement, and then that all qualifies under rhythm for me. I mean, slowing down and speeding up. That's all we do, I think, in a certain way in architecture. So it doesn't have to be literally. And of course, and you can go also literally because there is a rhythm here. There is a, you know, somebody has decided in this particular case that the wall that separates windows is the same width as the window itself. But I could imagine like a whole catalog of possibilities. You know, the polar opposite would be to leave out all the walls and have a glass building, to have like just punched holes in a massive wall and everything in between. So wouldn't you say that that's also rhythm? We have to wrap it up. Thank you so much. And I hope to see all of you back in May next year. But we will keep you posted for the exhibition. So then we will see if it works in real terms. Thank you so much. And let's just once again just congratulate everybody who took part by
what night?
to know if I've got it right now in
yes,
my
yes,
mind.
Sir.
If I would distinguish the way.
Yeah.
The way